Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. We are very privileged this morning to be joined by Arno Agus. He is the author of Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond. Arno Agus holds a Master in Political Science from McGill University, and he is a journalist and lecturer who is the author of Democracy in Cuba and the 1997-1998 Elections. Someone who truly can guide us through the relationships between Cuba and the U.S. Welcome to our show, Arno.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for having me once again.
Thank you for joining us. Now, for many people, Cuba, it's a small country, and maybe some may not be aware of the very raucous relationship between Cuba and the U.S. Can you briefly outline the historic relationship between Cuba and the United States?
Yes, firstly, we'd have to start with the fact that initially, during several centuries, Cuba was a colony of Spain. In the 19th century, the Cuban patriots, people who were inspired by the need for Cuban sovereignty, for social justice, and also the end of slavery, because as we know, under Spain, Cuba was basically a slave society, they began a war of independence against Spain in the second half of the 19th century, for social justice, sovereignty, and independence. And they were on the verge of winning in 1898 when the United States intervened under the pretext, oh, we're going to help the Cubans against Spain. But they did nothing of the sort. Instead of allowing Cuba to become an independent state, they took over from Spain as being the dominant colonial force in Cuba. And from 1898, that was the situation in Cuba. United States dominated Cuba that whole period until the 1950s, when a revolutionary movement started under the leadership of Fidel Castro, Raul Castro, Che Guevara, and others to, you know, continue what was started in the previous century, but bring it to a successful end. And so in the 1950s, they started a revolutionary armed uprising against the Batista regime, which was a dictatorship supported by the United States. And finally, they won victory in 1959, and for the first time, Cuba was fully liberated, and then the whole story of the Cuban Revolution started with its application of its goals for social justice, independence, sovereignty. The problem came up when they insisted on having their own program domestically and internationally to support other peoples of the world. As all the listeners can probably guess, the United States didn't like that. So to make a long story short, what the United States did was to break relations with Cuba right not too long after the revolution, shut down the embassies which were established before 1959, and impose a blockade against Cuba that has been going on all this time. This basic situation remained the same until December 17th, 2014. And I, like many other people, were really surprised when we saw on television that joint statement at the same time, simultaneously, by Barack Obama as President of the United States and Raul Castro as President of Cuba on that day, December 17, 2014, announcing there's a major change in Cuba-U.S. relations. United States recognizes the Cuban state and will establish diplomatic relations and embassy in Havana, and the Cuba will reopen its embassy in Washington, D.C. Since then, everything has changed. It had a major repercussion in Cuba, as you can guess. This is the first time this has happened over five centuries. And then we come to the Trump era, which, while he made a lot of bombastic statements against Cuba in June 2017, he had to maintain diplomatic relations with Cuba and did not shut down the embassy in Havana as he had promised during the election campaign. So we're presently in a very complicated situation where the Trump mandate is still being worked out by his administration, while Cuba, on the other hand, as it has done over five centuries, said we're willing to discuss and negotiate, but we will not give up on our principles of sovereignty and our right to decide our own economic and political system. That is it in a nutshell.
That's a beautifully brief and very succinct. Now, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about this, because I think the complexity of the relationships is encapsulated, I would say, in the idea of colonialism and imperialism. And there's a very defining, aspect to both. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how being a colony affected, but now this imperialistic view that one country can determine how other countries should rule themselves affects not only the development of a country, and in particular how the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Cuba post-1959 after they decided to become an independent state affected their development.
Yeah, I like that question because it allows you and I to exchange and the listeners to think about this important point. And what I call the outlook of colonialism and imperialism. In the Cuban case, one really has to go back to the very beginning of the 13 colonies in the 17th century with regards to Cuba. Right from the very initial stages, the first president of the United States at that time, the 13 colonies, George Washington, and the successive presidents at that time viewed Cuba, another state for Cuba. They saw that Cuba, it was not natural for Cuba, being only 90 miles from the United States, not being part of the American Union. And thus, the basic foreign policy towards Cuba from the beginning has been to incorporate Cuba into the, as you say, the colonial and imperialist system. And this is the basic outlook. Now, the main underlying conception, which I think you are getting to, and I think I agree with you, is important, is what I would call the Eurocentric notion of how one sees a political system. That is, the only judges of a political system was at the initial stages Europe during the colonial times, but this has been taken up the United States as the main imperialist power over the last 100 years or so. And the question of democracy, how many political parties, the question of the economic system, what they call the market system, or which is really another term for the capitalist system, that this is the only value, this is the judge of whether a country is on the right path or not. And what happened then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, is that as soon as Cuba went on its own path in 1959-1960, the United States didn't like it. And as you say, they imposed sanctions mainly in the form of blockade, which increased over time from the 1961 to 1992, 1996, was increasingly more harsh against Cuba, including also making the blockade or sanctions extraterritorial, in the sense that it was not just the United States against Cuba, but any third country such as Canada who deals with Cuba could also, according to the American law, be punished for dealing with Cuba. We had an example previously about 10 years ago where the Sheraton company deals with Cuba, has been dealing with Cuba for many years and has very good business relations and even political relations with Cuba. But the United States tried everything to dissuade this Canadian company from dealing with Cuba. And a more recent example I can give you, it may be hard to believe, but this is only a few months ago, when United States fined Honda Canada because Honda Canada was selling cars or dealing with cars with the Canadian embassy and the consulates in Cuba. This is a Canadian company, Honda Canada, but it was fined by the United States. So it just goes to show you how far these sanctions go. They affect other countries. They try everything to stop other countries from dealing with Cuba, including the United States dealing with Cuba. So this has you know, great. It's difficult to underestimate the negative effects. A negative effects is really a diplomatic term, but I agree with the Cubans when they say the blockade is genocidal. Why do I agree with that? Because the basic notion of the blockade was enunciated in black and white in 1961 by a United States official when he said that the blockade, the goal of the blockade, and this I'm quoting, paraphrasing, but quoting, the goal of the blockade, said this American official, is to make life miserable for the Cuban people, so they become disenchanted and revolt against their own Cuban government. That is the goal. That is, we're going to make you suffer, and if you don't give in, the only way forward is to revolt against the Cuban government and ally yourself with the United States. So this open attempt to make Cuba suffer has been developed for over five decades, and it's been accumulating. The side effects have been accumulating all these years, which has a major impact on its economy, on the social fabric of the country and all that. I think, of course, you know, we know, the Cubans know, all, you know, people who study Cuba, we know that Cuba has its own domestic internal problems regarding the economic situation, for example, regarding the fact that the state was too highly centralized previously, something that they actually are eliminating now as one of the negative features of the economy, having it more decentralized, and there are other problems as well. But all this is secondary, in my view, to the effects of the blockade against Cuba. One can imagine, with all Cuba had everything that Cuba has accomplished in terms of health, education, and the fact there's no one's on the street, that everyone has a home, everyone has three meals a day, everyone has education, access to sports, health, and all. Imagine if Cuba did not have that blockade on their backs for five decades, what Cuba could accomplish as a third world country. It is really outstanding. And this, I guess, this is what the United States does not want to happen, because even under these conditions, Cuba still stands as a model and inspiration for many people around the world who are looking to an alternative to capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism. Cuba is a symbol of a country that stands on its own feet, has principles, and does not fear to stand up to the bullying by the United States, whether it's the approach by Obama of the, you know, the carrot approach, or the, you know, smiling Ivy League professor, the smooth talker, or the more obnoxious approach by Trump. Cuba does not give in to any of the, you know, the Cuban said on several occasions, including the foreign minister, who I respect a lot, Bruno Rodriguez, he said a while ago, look, no one can beguile Cuba. We know what's going on. We do not go for the carrot and stick policy, for example, using the carrot now with Cuba and the stick against Venezuela. We stand with Venezuela, etc. So this is a very sharp struggle that's going on, not only between Cuba and the United States, but on the international front with regards to opposing all attempts by the United States to dominate Cuba and the region.
So can we talk a little bit about the way this blockade was sustained? Because surely there must have been approval from other countries we do have a United Nations. We do have, you know, legal entities on a global scale that that approve or decline these propositions. Who approved the sanctions against Cuba, and how were they sustained?
That is important to discuss. The only government that approved the sanctions, the blockade against Cuba, is the United States of America. They're the ones who enacted the laws with regards to the blockade without any consultation with any other countries. Now, what is interesting to know, in the United Nations, as you mentioned, there have been yearly votes regarding the blockade. Every year, the General Assembly votes on a motion that Cuba puts forward, which states that the United Nations, or all countries in the United Nations, should vote against the blockade, that the blockade should be lifted. Basically, that is the demand of the Cuban resolution. Now, at the initial stages, United States, of course, and Israel and others opposed the Cuban resolution to lift the blockade, but they were also joined by many other countries, especially in Europe, but still a minority. Now, the majority in favor of lifting blockade was overwhelming over the years, but what was really important over the last, like about 3 years ago, the only two countries that voted in favor of the United States was United States and Israel. So that answers your question, that it's basically the ones who sanction, who agree with the blockade in the United Nations, according to their own resolutions, are just United States and Israel. And last year, for the first time, I guess Obama wanted to have this as part of his legacy, for the first time, United States and Israel did not dare to vote against the Cuban resolution to lift the blockade, but abstained. I mean, it's a step forward, but still, it does not make a major difference. Now, I'm glad that you mentioned the word sanctions, because so far, right now, all of the countries in the world support the lifting of the blockade, and two countries are neutral, such as the United States and Israel. So the question arises, what is the role of the United Nations in the world today? How come a situation such as this evolved, where a five-decade-long genocidal blockade and sanctions against a small country by the empire takes place, and in the United Nations General Assembly, everyone is against it? Now, how come there is no mechanism in the General Assembly or the more restricted body of the General Assembly? How come there is no mechanism for sanctions to be imposed against the United States for imposing this blockade against Cuba for over five decades, and against which all of the members of the United States, the whole planet, is against it? Sometimes I get the feeling, if I just may get emotional for a couple of seconds, it seems to me that the word sanctions only applies to when the United States wants sanctions against another country that does not follow the position of the United States. I mean, I think that, I'm not an expert in how the UN operates, but it seems logical to me, and I think listeners will say, yeah, how come there's no sanctions against the United States when all of the countries in the United States vote in favor of lifting the blockade?
So can we talk a little bit about the way Cuba has managed to flourish in spite of all this negative influences around it, in spite of all the aggression against it? It has managed to flourish and create one of the most admirable social systems, and in terms of education, in terms of housing, in terms of sustaining its population's basic needs.
I think we cannot say that Cuba has flourished. I think we can say that despite everything, Cuba has held its own. With regards, when I say everything, I mean especially the blockade and it being a third world country that only recently came out of five centuries of slavery and colonialism. Cuba, despite everything, maintains its basic goals set forth in 1959 by Fidel Castro and the other leaders. That is social justice, education, health, housing for all, etc. Now, this is going on. Like, for example, one can ask the question, how come, despite all these problems, that Cuba still maintains its education, health, etc.? When the Soviet Union fell through in the end of the 1980s, and most of Cuba's trade with the ex-Soviet Union was completely eliminated in the course of several days, despite that, not one school in Cuba was closed. Not one polyclinic, not one hospital in Cuba was closed. Because Cuba is it is the opposite of a market or capitalist system. It is a socialist system. That is, all of the results of work, etc., go back into the economy to be spent on the basic needs of the people, such as health, education, trying to improve housing, sports facilities, etc. That is, because there is no capitalism there, that a handful of capitalists, such as the United States or Canada, can profit over anything that happens in their respective countries and take it all for themselves, and in this way even increase their profits more, the Cuban system is opposite. Nothing goes to individuals. It all works for the state. That is, irrespective, like even for example now, Cuba has produced so many doctors that they're able to send doctors to other countries in Latin America, to Africa, etc. Now, when they go to these other countries, the receiving countries, pay Cuba back for these medical services. Now, this is, not many people know that, this is probably the main source of foreign revenue for Cuba at this time, even more than tourism. Now, what is important here? This money that is sent as a payment by a local government, say, whether it's in Guatemala, El Salvador, or Venezuela, or Bolivia, it goes into Cuba, and it is this money, aside from paying the Cuban doctors a supplementary fee, most of this money goes into the Cuban economy to maintain its health, education, and social services. This is extremely important. A capitalist system can never do anything like that. They cannot have a surplus of doctors to send out to others as a gest of solidarity, nor can they use funds coming into the country for the well-being of the people. I can give you another example. For a lot of people talking now about how the Cuba has decentralized, which I think is a good thing, and a lot of small private enterprises are being encouraged to flourish. For example, those who work in small, B&B houses, renting out their homes, or small restaurants, etc. These are developing quite a bit. At the same time, it should not be, and in the main, it is this new private enterprise cannot be a source of personal enrichment. Now, this means that when these private enterprises get their revenues and other sources of income, they have to pay taxes on that to the Cuban state. And these taxes are another source for the Cuban state to maintain its basic program of health, social and economic security for the people. And there are many other examples to show how the system, the social system, despite its shortcomings, despite its necessity to upgrade itself, to improve it as the Cuban themselves are doing, can do miracles simply because it is not capitalist and is not based, as you mentioned, on the egocentric notion of a society. It's based on collectivity, solidarity, domestically and internationally. And it is, despite everything, a great symbol, a great the people of the world at this time.
You mentioned that these are achievements that were made in spite of the sanctions, despite the blockade, despite 5 decades of invasion in terms of blockades. So what happens now? You mentioned the momentum of 2014, December 17, when President Obama made this new agreement to change the policy in Cuba, the policy of sanctions. So what has changed, and what can we expect now with the new president in role?
Okay, the first part of your question, what has changed with Obama? One has to keep in mind the following, and I keep on hammering away on that in my book, and when I speak on TV and radio, it's important. Obama said when he reached that agreement, and after that the American policy regarding Cuba has failed. It has not been a success, and therefore we have to change it. Now, the other part of that sentence is important to take into consideration as well. He said it did not succeed because we did not succeed in achieving our main goal, and that is subverting the Cuban Revolution. He also said it did not succeed because our goal was to isolate Cuba from the rest of Latin America, when in fact, he admitted, the opposite took place. The United States was increasingly isolated from the rest of Latin America, mainly because of its Cuban policy. So while the relations were established in December 2014 and had been developing since then, it has largely been, and the Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Cuban officials also say, it is basically a one-way street. That is, how can it help the United States? How does American investments in Cuba help the United States? Or how they try to assist the private small businesses in Cuba, for the simple reason they would like to have these small private businesses develop the notion of the American dream and bring them under the influence of U.S. domination. And there are many other examples. It's basically like, while Obama spoke a lot about the blockade, his mandate during the 8 years has fined foreign banking institutions who trade with Cuba, based on what I mentioned earlier, the extraterritorial nature of blame, more than any other previous president. So, you know, that hasn't changed. The basic nature of the blockade still remains in force despite the agreement. Now, with regards to Trump, one thing to keep in mind is the following. During the election campaign, Trump had two basic narratives. One was, well, I think that when he's asked the question, I think Obama opening is a good thing, but we could have gotten a better deal. And so he basically said he would go along. At the same time, when he was in Miami campaigning, he would say, I'm against the Obama deal. When I come to power, I'm going to end everything, close the embassy, end all diplomatic relations with Cuba, unless Cuba agrees to change. So he had basically two different positions. Now, his basic position was exposed on June 16, 2017 in Miami. And there was a lot of news about how bombastic he was against Cuba, etc., which he was, very obnoxious to say the least. At the same time, my analysis, my view is that it was basically, he was basically in a defensive position. At that June 16 meeting, he did everything, but he did not reverse the principal feature of the Obama policy, that is, diplomatic relations and embassies remaining open. He maintained that. So a lot of the talk that he did that day was mainly, for the gallery there in Miami, trying to convince them that he's really against the Cuban regime. But he still maintained diplomatic relations and the embassy, which the Cuban Miamis did not want. They wanted to end that. So it was basically a compromise by Trump and the Miami crowd. Now, all of the rules with regards to restricting trade and restricting travel to Cuba that he announced recently, and in which there was a lot of news, have not been finally worked out. I've noticed recently that despite his opposition to more trade and travel to Cuba, important travel industry components in the United States, such as JetBlue, just a couple of days ago, announced, despite Trump's position, they're opening two ticket offices in Havana. American Airlines and others have did similar things over the last few months, and they're important travel industry giants such as Airbnb, such as Expedia.com, who have relationship with Cuba and want to continue it to his attempt to reverse.
You have been very generous with us. Thank you so much for joining us today. My guest is Arnold Agus. He is the author of Cuba, U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond, and his older book, but very good, which has been translated in many languages, is Cuba and Its Neighbors, Democracy in Motion. Thank you so much for being with us. Any parting words?
Yes, well, thank you for your very important question. My only parting words is to allow your listeners to know that there are several book launches taking place in Canada, one in Ottawa on October 27th, another in Montreal on September 27th in Ottawa, in Montreal on October 11th, and then in Toronto on October 13th. People could go onto my website or Google it. They will find the venues and all the information with regards to those book launching, and my website is www.cubarelations.com, or just go on my Facebook page, Arnold August. Everything will be there as well.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yes, bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.